You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Martha Plimpton, in for Leonard Lopate. In 2008, voters in California approved Proposition 8, which prohibited same-sex marriages in the Golden State. You probably know the rest of the story. There was a trial and a ruling to strike down Prop 8, an appeal, and eventually the case made its way to the highest court in the land. Last month, the Supreme Court allowed a lower court's ruling to stand, and same-sex marriages have resumed in California. Here to talk about the decision is David Boies, who was the co-lead counsel, along with Ted Olson, one of the legal team which challenged Prop 8. He's also the chairman of Boies, Schiller, and Flexner, and it's a pleasure to welcome David Boies back to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Hello.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be back.
Thank you so much for joining us. So it was announced yesterday, and I'm always interested in showbiz topics, that HBO that HBO is going to release a documentary about your legal challenge to Prop 8. And aren't you and Ted Olson also working on a book about your experiences?
Yes, we are. A number of people have asked us to write something on it, not so much because we were central to it, but because the perch that we had for this controversy over the last 5 years has really been unique.
Yes, you certainly have probably the best inside perspective you can get. Were you surprised or maybe even frustrated that the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act but didn't actually use the Prop 8 case as an opportunity to really overturn anti-gay marriage laws and amendments in all the states which have them?
No, this was actually the result that we had predicted. We'd predicted that we would probably need additional litigation to get the Supreme Court to actually face what is called the merits issue.
Right.
That is, whether the Proposition 8 type legislation or constitutional provisions in state constitutions violates the federal constitution.
Mm-hmm.
The district court in California, the federal district court, held that Proposition 8 and all statutes like it were unconstitutional and invalid under the federal constitution. But to get the Supreme Court to consider that question, there has to be what is called standing.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that the person who is appealing that decision has got to have some kind of injury as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
And because, as we demonstrated at trial, permitting gay and lesbian citizens to marry the people they love can't hurt anybody.
Right.
Nobody other than the state has standing to defend the state statute.
And do you sort of wish that California officials had defended the law?
Well, I think that it would have been good, I think, to have this issue resolved once and for all.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I wouldn't ever suggest that people ought to go in and defend a law that they know is unconstitutional.
Of course.
And I think the state officials did the right thing after the district court ruled by recognizing the unconstitutionality of this kind of discrimination.
This may be an unfair question to ask you, but do you think the court wanted to maybe avoid a sweeping ruling on the broader question of same-sex marriage?
I think it might have. I think it's very hard to tell. You'll recall that when the Supreme Court announced Brown against Board of Education.
Yeah.
They didn't order immediate end to segregation.
Mm-hmm.
They used the phrase all deliberate speed. And what it did was it gave states and communities that were most opposed to racial justice an opportunity to adjust.
Mm-hmm.
It made clear where we were going to end up. But it gave some of the states a little time to adapt. And if you look at the district court decision in our case, which the Supreme Court let stand, and you look at the language in the majority opinion in the DOMA case, I don't think there can be any question of how this is going to end up.
Right.
This kind of discrimination is clearly unconstitutional. And it's recognized, I think, by an increasingly large percentage of the American people, and virtually every person 30 and under, that not only is this kind of discrimination terribly harmful and unconstitutional, but it is so unnecessary. it's really absurd.
Yeah.
And I think that everybody knows where we're going here.
So the court
and
did.
I think that they wanted to give a little time.
So, but the court, you think, did really sort of provide a roadmap here with this?
Oh, absolutely. When the majority opinion in the DOMA case says that it is unconstitutional to discriminate against people based on moral or religious judgments, and says there is no legitimate state interest in distinguishing between same-sex couples and gay couples, heterosexual couples and gay couples.
Right.
The court has essentially said there's no constitutional basis for this kind of discrimination. And even somebody like Justice Scalia, who has been one of the opponents of marriage equality, recognized in his dissent that the game's over. I mean, he explicitly says that while the majority opinion has not reached the merits question in the Perry case, the California case, they've clearly decided it.
So what happens now when a gay couple gets married, say, in New York State and then moves to, let's say, Kansas? The federal government views them as married, but not the state house in Topeka, let's say?
Well, there is a provision of our Constitution called the Full Faith and Credit Clause.
Okay.
And it says that every state has got to give full faith and credit to the acts of sister states. And you'll recall, maybe you won't recall because you may not old enough, but I recall when it was very hard to get divorces in many states, and people would go to Nevada to get a divorce. But when they came back, they were divorced.
Right.
Because the state that they came from had to recognize that the state of Nevada had divorced them. And I think that the same thing is going to be eventually held to be true of these marriages, that the courts are going to hold that Kansas or Texas or Alabama or Georgia has got to give full faith and credit to marriages performed in New York and California and Iowa and Maine and Maryland.
Do you think that the Supreme Court will eventually find a constitutional right to same-sex marriage in the near future or far future?
I think the answer is the next time that they're presented with a question, I believe they are clearly going to hold that there is a constitutional right for everyone to marry the person that they love, gay, straight, or whatever. Now, I think that when that happens is uncertain, and it's uncertain for two reasons. First, it's a little uncertain when a case gets back to the Supreme Court. It takes time. It took us about 4 years, a little over 4 years, from the time we filed the complaint until we got a Supreme Court judgment. So it takes some time. The second thing that is uncertain is the Supreme Court doesn't have to take these cases. It can decide when it takes a case. And one of the interesting things in the oral argument was that two or three of the justices were saying, maybe we took this case too early. Maybe we should have let the circuit courts of appeals develop the law a little bit for us to review. So it could be that the next time that we have a decision on marriage equality, constitutional decision on marriage equality at a federal court of appeals level, the Supreme Court just lets it sit there. It doesn't review it because it doesn't have to review it. So I can't tell you exactly when the Supreme Court will rule, but I can tell you when they rule, how they will rule.
I'm Martha Plimpton in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with David Boies, co-lead counsel with Ted Olson in the case which overturned California's Prop 8, or I guess it didn't really overturn it technically, right?
Well, it did overturn it
because
the district court opinion held it unconstitutional and joined its enforcement.
Right.
And that's the ruling in the case that the United States Supreme Court allowed to stand.
So you and Ted Olson were courtroom adversaries in one of the in one of the most contentious Supreme Court decisions in recent memory, anyway, Bush v. Gore. How did the two of you come to be friends and eventually join up to challenge Prop 8?
I had always had a great deal of respect for Ted, and I thought the way he handled himself in Bush v. Gore, although we were on opposite sides and disagreed and argued our cases very passionately, I thought the way he handled himself and the way he handled the case was great. He showed enormous amount of integrity and really focused on the legal issues that were involved. We'd known each other some before that, and we became increasingly good friends after that. We both share an interest in biking. We go on bike trips. In fact, we're going on a bike trip to Ireland later this month.
Oh, that's fabulous.
We both like to sail.
You could maybe do a buddy movie, I guess, about
exactly
this.
Right. I'm not sure what the ratings would be, but
I think it would do very well, very well. So, what is it that drew the two of you to marriage equality, to the fight?
I think it was two things. I mean, first of all, it was in part, I think, we wanted to work together, but much more important than that was we both recognized this issue as the defining civil rights issue of our generation.
Yeah.
When I was a young lawyer in the middle and late 60s, I spent time with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights in Jackson, Mississippi. And that was, for people that were just coming of age then, the defining civil rights issue that we faced. This is the defining civil rights issue. This is the last area where the government discriminates against its own citizens in broad ways. There's lots of social discrimination. We've got a long, long way before we as a country fulfill the promise of our Declaration of Independence. But we've at least stopped government discrimination, where the government itself discriminates against its own citizens, for the most part. This is really the last bastion of that kind of discrimination. And I think it's critical, not only for gays and lesbian couples and the children that they're raising, but for all Americans, to eliminate this last blot on our claim to be a nation that prizes equality and allowing everyone to pursue happiness in their own way. So I think that both of us felt that this was a critical issue to take on, not only for our clients, but really for America. We also, I think, thought that this was a case that it was important to send a message that this is not a Republican or Democratic issue, not a conservative or liberal issue. This is an issue of human rights, of civil rights, that all Americans, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, ought to be supportive of. And I think that having Ted, who is probably the leading conservative lawyer in the country, and myself, who has a much more liberal orientation and background, joined together to do that was something that we wanted to. We really wanted people to understand the nature of this issue. And we wanted people to see that people who disagree passionately on many things can still come together and work for things that they agree on.
I'm speaking with attorney David Boies, who was the co-lead counsel, along with Ted Olson, in the legal challenge to California's Proposition 8. We'll have more with David Boies after the break. Hi, I'm Martha Plimpton, and you're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show. I'm speaking with David Boies, the co-lead counsel with Ted Olson, who argued against the Proposition 8 in California. David, many other states had gay marriage bans on the books longer than California did. Why did you choose to challenge Proposition 8 in court? Why that case?
In other words, why did we choose California?
Exactly.
I think there were several reasons. One of the most important was that California is the largest state in the union. More than one out of every 10 American citizens live in California. We were at the same time pursuing legislative marriage equality in New York, And we believe that if we were able to establish marriage equality in both New York and California, that is something that would, as a practical matter, seal the issue. You can't have a country that is as mobile as our country is, where the two leading states of New York and California both have adopted equal rights for people, mm-hmm. and then have other people continuing to try to discriminate. So we thought that just because of its size and its centrality to popular culture, California was an important place to start.
Kind of a no-brainer.
In addition, we had clients who lived in California who wanted to get married. And mm-hmm. first and foremost, a lawsuit is about your clients.
Right. And that actually, leads to my next question, which has to do with how you selected your plaintiffs. So, for example, the plaintiffs in Loving v. Virginia, which struck down interracial marriage bans around the country, were essential in that case's victory. Even the name Loving seems to aid
yes.
their cause. What did you look yeah. for when you were looking for your plaintiffs?
Well, it would have been nice to find somebody whose name was Loving. but what we did was really respond mm-hmm. to these particular plaintiffs who right. are just wonderful people. Mm-hmm. Both Ted and I have repeatedly said that the best argument that we can make for marriage equality would simply to be have people read their testimony, and even better, to see their testimony. The testimony was actually videotaped, uh-huh. but the opponents won a ruling from the Supreme Court that said 5-4 mm-hmm. that said the tapes could not be publicly released.
Right.
Now, why?
Yeah.
There's any basis to hold back the tapes of people who are willing to have those tapes revealed? It's a little hard to understand.
Did people feel like maybe that could be a sign that the court was maybe aiming to rule against you later on, or what?
No, I don't think so, no. Because the Supreme Court is probably the most conservative institution that we have in this country with respect to cameras.
Right.
They don't allow any cameras in the Supreme Court.
Right.
I mean, can you imagine what would happen if Congress or the president tried to bar cameras? In fact,
yeah.
More than 20 years ago, 25 years ago, it was in the early 80s, so it was, I guess, almost 30 years ago now, representing CBS, I got a preliminary injunction, along with some other counsel, against Ronald Reagan for excluding cameras from what is called the tight news pool, on the grounds that violated the First Amendment. So I think that in any other public institution, you would have much more coverage than you do in the Supreme Court, and they've got some reasons for that.
Mm.
But the result is that I don't think you can read anything into
right.
a decision to narrow the use of cameras or videotape.
So Chief U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker took up the case. And a lot of activists in the anti-gay marriage community were upset by the fact that he's gay. Did you know he was gay going into the trial?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay.
Everybody knew he was gay. It's worth noting
mm-hmm.
that they weren't upset with him until he ruled.
Right. right. That's a very good point.
I mean, they knew
right.
he was gay. In fact, people came to them and said, do you have an objection? And they were quoted publicly in the press in San Francisco, mm-hmm. saying, no, we don't have any objection. This is a question of law.
Right. Well, I guess it would have looked pretty lousy if they had, huh?
Yeah, it would have, because are you going to say that African Americans can't rule on decisions involving racial injustice?
Right, of course.
Should Thurgood Marshall have disqualified himself every time a racial justice case came before the United States Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Are you going to say that? I mean, look at gender discrimination. Nobody could do it. You know, women couldn't do it, men couldn't do it, because they're both affected by it.
Were you surprised by Judge Walker's decision to examine not only the constitutionality of Prop 8, but also to look at the evidence on whether same-sex marriage should be banned at all, even in the first place? Or did you expect him to?
No. We asked him to do that.
Because
we believed that we wanted to give the court several ways to strike the statute down, mm-hmm. or the initiative down. One way was simply to hold that there could be no discrimination. It violated the Constitution. We believe that that is the case, and the court found that that was the case. And the Supreme Court's decision in DOMA very strongly states that that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, though, we wanted to have narrower grounds because the first and foremost thing a lawyer wants to do is a lawyer wants to win. If you can win broadly, that's great, but first you want to be sure that you win your case.
Mm-hmm.
And so we gave the court a number of alternative, narrower grounds to decide it on.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what it felt like when the case finally made its way to the Supreme Court? I mean, I know you've argued in front of the court many times,
right.
but in this particular case, what was that like for you?
I think both Ted and I believe that this was the most important case we've ever done.
Really?
It was a case of really historic importance, and I think that each of us felt privileged to be involved in it. Neither of us really had been actively involved in this before maybe 5-10 years ago. And a lot of other people sort of carried this torch during times when it was much more difficult than it was during the last several years when Ted and I were doing this. So I think that we felt really privileged to be able to participate in bringing this issue to a conclusion.
Yeah.
And when it went to the Supreme Court, I think we both knew that this was going to be the most important case that we had ever done.
And so was waiting for the actual decision any different for you than
it was?
It was. Yeah.
I mean, and the thing is, the Supreme Court, there's good news and bad news about the Supreme Court's decision-making process.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is that you know that virtually every case that is argued will be decided by the end of June.
Right.
That is, it's not a situation like a court, sometimes appellate courts, like hold a case.
Right.
Sometimes for months and months, sometimes even for multiple years before they decide it. You know the Supreme Court's going to give you a decision relatively quickly. The bad news is you don't know when it's going to come.
Yeah.
And so as you get closer and closer to the end of the court, you have more and more anticipation.
Right.
And we got to the last week of the court term, and there was only one day where they had listed for the court to sit.
Right.
Which was Monday, the 24th of June.
Right.
So we went into court, Ted and I did, and sat there, and they read three or four opinions, and then the Chief Justice banged down his gavel and said, "Court's adjourned until tomorrow."
I remember that. The tension, the suspense was killing all of us, I think.
It was. I mean, and then we trooped back into court on Tuesday, and we listened to another three or four decisions, and then the Chief Justice bangs down his gavel and says, "Court is adjourned until tomorrow," which will be the last day.
Oh, man.
And really, unfortunately, that Wednesday was a day that Ted had to be in Philadelphia arguing another case.
Oh, brother.
And so having lived with this for 4 years and having sort of waited on Monday and Tuesday, he had to be gone, and he didn't get to be there when they actually announced the decision.
Right.
One regret about it is that we weren't together when we got the decision.
Yeah. Boy.
We did, however, both he flew from Philadelphia, I flew from Washington, and we both met in California later that day, and there was a great rally in West Hollywood that we both were able to enjoy.
I'm Martha Plimpton in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with David Boies, co-lead counsel with Ted Olson in the Prop 8 case. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. So I understand that the Prop 8 trials become the basis of a play written
yes.
by Dustin Lance Black called 8. And in its 2011 theatrical debut, you were played, well, really by two really very good actors.
Yes.
One of my favorites. The first was Ed Begley Jr. What was that like?
Well, Ed Begley Jr. actually played me in the movie Recount.
Oh, my goodness.
He played me in the... in the movie that was made
about
the Bush
v. Gore. Oh, my goodness. Oh, but you wait,
and
George Clooney played you in the play.
He did, and Morgan Freeman did as well.
Oh, how fabulous. I love that casting. It's very public theater.
Yeah, Morgan Freeman played me in the Broadway showing of the play. And
George Clooney did it in L.A.?
In L.A., yeah.
What was that like? What's the experience of watching an actor play you?
It was great. The only thing that concerned me is that if any of my clients heard either Morgan Freeman or George Clooney read my lines, because they just read the lines that I'd used in court,
right?
They would have thought that they wanted those people representing them rather than me, because it came out of their mouths a lot better than it came out of mine.
Yeah, that's why they hire the actors, right?
Exactly.
That's our job.
Yeah.
That's so funny. And what about, do you think if you write a book, do you want to sell the movie rights to somebody and have, I don't know, who could you have play you in that movie? Maybe Matt Damon.
I'm sticking with Morgan Freeman and George Clooney.
Stick with Morgan. Have them both do it in the same movie.
Right.
That would be kind of an interesting choice. Maybe David Lynch could direct it or something.
Right.
I don't know. So after oral arguments before the Supreme Court, a lot of commentators try to sort of read the tea leaves, as it were, and sort of divine what the justices' questions mm-hmm. say about how they might rule. Do you think there's any validity at all to that?
Yes, there is some validity.
Okay.
And there's more validity for the Supreme Court than there is for many other courts.
Mm-hmm.
In many other courts, the judges in an oral argument are, for the most part, probing the lawyer's argument,
mm-hmm.
trying to understand, trying to test. In the Supreme Court, that happens. But in addition, what happens is that when the judges are asking a question, they're really arguing with their brethren or sisters mm-hmm. on the court. Sometimes, doesn't happen very often, but sometimes one justice will ask a question that's kind of a loaded question one way, and another justice will jump right in before the lawyer even has a chance to mm-hmm. answer the question. So they are in significant part arguing with themselves in public.
Yeah.
While your argument is going on. So you can't ever predict with great precision what they're going to hold, but you often get a pretty good indication of which way they're going to come out.
Right. And now, of course, gay people, LGBT people still face some major obstacles on a number of fronts, and in many states, workplace
yes.
discrimination still legal. Do you think gays and lesbians will be able to win more and more rights in the courts or in state legislatures now that the federal government recognizes their marriages? You think this
Absolutely.
Is a domino that's been tipped?
Absolutely, because one of the reasons that we thought that marriage equality was so important was that when you're talking about discrimination, discrimination in areas of sex and marriage is always one of the most sensitive, if not the most sensitive issue.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that it was over a decade after Brown against Board of Education mm-hmm. that the Supreme Court struck down bans on interracial marriage. So that even after Brown against Board of Education had been the law of the land for more than a decade. 16 states still enforced laws, criminal laws, prohibiting interracial marriage. So one of the things that we believed is that if we could establish marriage equality, all other discrimination would eventually fall. And I think if you look at the principles that the district court, in our case, the Federal Court of Appeals, in our case, the United States Supreme Court, in the DOMA case, has articulated, those principles should make any kind of state action discrimination unconstitutional.
So yesterday, a Senate committee approved the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would prohibit workplace discrimination against gays, lesbians, and trans people. And it even picked up support of Orrin Hatch, of all people. It's pretty amazing.
Yes.
So do you think the Republican Party's starting to go through, starting to shift on this? Will it have to?
I absolutely do. And what is maybe not as well recognized as it should be is that over the last 4 years, we've picked up a number of really critical Republican voices.
Mm.
I mean, Ken Mellman, who really was instrumental in Republican elections, you know, at the Republican National Committee. Alan Simpson, great senator.
Right.
And leader, a Republican leader in the Senate, in a leadership position,
mm-hmm.
Are just two examples. But there are lots and lots of Republicans, I think, who have spoken out. And if you think about it, that really ought to be expected. The Cato Institute, one of the most conservative organizations in the country, strongly supports marriage equality because they recognize that it is an element of liberty. And that the government ought not to be interfering with. Conservatives, at least as much as liberals, mm-hmm. have an interest in seeing the government stay out of people's private lives.
And so just quickly, what's right now the legal situation for binational gay couples following the Supreme Court rulings of last month?
Well, a binational gay couple from Florida just received permission for the spouse to join.
Oh, great!
And I think that is where this administration and I think the country
mm-hmm.
is going. I think that the court and I think the courts, plural, have recognized that when you have a marriage that is celebrated in a jurisdiction that recognizes it. The international community and other states really have an obligation to recognize that marriage as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been fascinating, and I really appreciate you calling in to talk with me today.
Oh, absolutely.
I've been speaking with David Boies, the chairman of Boies, Schiller & Flexner. He was also the co-lead counsel, along with Ted Olson, in the legal challenge to California's Proposition 8. David, thank you so much. It's been a huge pleasure speaking with you today.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, and hey, by the way, the Sacramento Bee is already running stories about gay divorce in California. So I guess,
I know. Well, that's,
you
that's
know,
the next
if we're going to be getting married, then we're going to be getting divorced, too, aren't we?
Absolutely right. It is sort of an equal opportunity situation.
I know. And don't you think it's been awesome how the public's support of this has sort of been accelerated recently? I mean,
absolutely.
It's almost as if like a switch got flipped.
That's absolutely right. And what has been really, really great is to see, particularly after this decision, everybody coming out and saying, yes, that was the right decision. I mean, you've got some people who make a profession out of sort of anti-gay statements. But
right.
For the vast majority of the American people, the people on Main Street, the people mm-hmm. across the country, they recognize that it's wrong to discriminate.
That's right.
Equality is baked into the American soul.
Mm-hmm.
And all we really needed to do is have an event like this that drew public attention to it. And people are saying, of course, why would I try to stop people from happiness?
That's
it doesn't
right.
help me.
Yeah, it doesn't. And you're so eloquent on the subject, and I know that there are a lot of people out there who think of you as a hero to many of us. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Up next, theater critic Peter Felicia on the history of the American musical, from the classics to the shows that did not win a Tony. I'm Martha Plimpton, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. ¶¶